Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Support for Violation comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
WBUR Podcasts, Boston.
This call will be recorded and subject to monitoring at any time. Thank you for using IC Solutions. You may begin speaking now.
Hey, Beth.
Hey there.
So I have the decision.
Hi, folks. It's Beth. Remember how I dropped in here in August to tell you the judge had held a hearing in Jake's case and we'd be back when he issued his ruling?
Under advisement ruling. On October 4th, 2023, this matter came before the court for argument on Weidman's second complaint for special action relief. At the conclusion of the hearing...
Well, here we are. I was in Dallas, reporting on a different story in October, when the phone rang. It was Josh Hamilton, Jake's attorney. He sounded like someone had died. I didn't have a tape recorder on me in the car that day, but I called him back later.
I opened it up, and the first thing that jumped off the page to me was that I thought it was very short. It was only about 2 pages long. And so as I quickly read through it, I was shocked, I guess.
There's a lot to say about the ruling itself, and we'll get to that. But the upshot is this. The judge ruled against Jake. He'll stay in prison, definitely for at least another year, possibly for the rest of his life.
I was really... surprised is not the word for it. I was shocked. I really was. Of all possible outcomes, I didn't think that one was very realistic.
I'm going to skip a thorough recap here, because the backstory is long and complicated, and if you're listening to this update, you probably already know it. If you haven't listened to Violation or our last update, please go back and listen to those first, or this update won't make much sense. But long story short, Jake was waiting on a Maricopa Superior Court judge to rule on his second special action, which, because you can't technically appeal a parole board's decision, is a sort of sideways way to argue before a judge that the board's actions were unfair. This time around, he was arguing that his second parole revocation hearing, which was ordered by a different judge in 2019, had been just as unfair as his first. And actually, the whole process raised red flags. Jake and his lawyers used that phrase, red flags. The evidence shows, and I'm quoting here, that the Arizona Corrections Department was actively searching for a reason to violate Weidman. That means to revoke his parole. And suggests it may have even deliberately orchestrated the violation. The oral arguments for that second special action were held in August, and that's when we brought you our last update.
All right. We're here in LC 2023-000053, Weidman versus the Department of Corrections.
Remember we told you that broadly the judge had three options? The first was to release Jake altogether. Jake and his lawyers knew this was a long shot, but they made the argument anyway. They said that when it comes to Jake's case, the parole board has acted in a way that's, quote, arbitrary and capricious and vindictive, and that because they can't be trusted to be fair, the judge should take the decision-making out of their hands and just reinstate Jake's parole and release him. The judge's second option was to order a second do-over of Jake's parole revocation hearing, with or without some additional guidance or guardrails. This is the outcome Jake thought he had a real chance of getting.
I thought the worst case scenario was that he would just simply send it back to the board with, you know, no instructions or anything like that, and give the board carte blanche again to essentially do what they wanted to do. But I didn't spend a lot of time even conceiving of the idea that he would shoot us down completely.
But that's exactly what happened. The judge's third option, the worst case scenario, as far as Jake was concerned, the one he says he didn't even spend much time thinking about because he didn't even think it was possible for the judge to find he'd been treated fairly under the law. Judge Mark Brain chose that third option. He said that Weidman failed to demonstrate a basis for relief. The entire decision, header and all, was 2.5 pages. Just as a point of comparison, the first judge's ruling on Jake's last special action was 16 pages.
The brevity of this opinion was a little bit like an emphatic period at the end of a sentence. Reading this made me feel as though the court was signaling enough is enough.
Daniel Medwed is a professor of criminal law at Northeastern Law School. He has no connection to this case, but I asked him to read the judge's ruling and some of the related documents. Jake's legal arguments to Judge Brain were 87 pages. The board's reply was 101 pages with appendices. Plus, the parties went back and forth in additional dozens of pages about whether the transcript of the revocation hearing was reliable and accurate. All of which is to say there were a lot of complex legal arguments to consider.
There was an element of exasperation in the tone of this that I found a little bit disturbing. Because, of course, I think Mr. Weidman's claim is an eminently credible one to make, which is, Arizona, tell me why I'm being recommitted. How possibly could my behavior here, my failure to set up this appointment, how could you go from that indiscretion to a finding of lapsing into criminal conduct? You know, show me the chain of inferences that led you there. And that strikes me as a very reasonable request. And if the board and the court had actually shown that chain of inferences more clearly and more transparently, I think I would have accepted this opinion more than I did.
But Judge Breen agreed with the board that the reasons they had provided to support the idea that Jake was returning to criminal ways were good enough. In fact, at the hearing in August, it was almost as if he invited the board's lawyer, her name is Kelly Gillian Gibson, to explain why they were good enough.
It would be improper for me to attempt to explain why a decision maker's decision was correct.
I don't even think you need to argue it's correct. I think you need to argue it's plausible.
What you can say is plausible is that the delay of time, how often Mr. Weidman delayed getting done what the parole officer asked him to do, suggests that he was avoiding complying and trying to manipulate the system.
And in his ruling, he wrote, quote, "The court is not authorized to substitute its judgment for the board's judgment, but instead merely to determine whether the board acted within its discretion." Here, there was evidence that Weidman's parole officer had prodded Weidman to begin counseling with Dr. McCain for some time, and he had failed to do so. Dr. McCain is that therapist who Jake was supposed to make an appointment with. And so Jake and his attorneys are back to square one. Except for the 9 months he was out on home arrest, Jake has now been behind bars for 37 years, and he has very few avenues out. He could appeal Judge Brain's decision to the Arizona Court of Appeals and then to the Arizona Supreme Court. If they deny him, he could move over to federal court and start a chain of appeals there. All of this could take years. Like any prisoner who was convicted in the 1980s, before Arizona abolished parole, he also has the option of having a parole board hearing each year and asking for release, just like he did for years. But legally speaking, said his lawyer, Josh Hamilton, doing that would mean he accepts the way things have gone down so far and gives up his chance to appeal it.
At a certain point, does Jake just, you know, throw up his hands and just start going before the board every year?
Do I put myself back in front of this parole board and explain to them why I'm an appropriate candidate for release on parole? Putting my faith in the same board that twice previously kept me in custody where I didn't deserve to be and wouldn't give me a fair hearing that adhered to the law. But do I trust that I can have a fair hearing on the merits as to re-release on parole? Or do I continue to advance my very real, very well-established legal arguments as to my initial detention in the first place? That's a decision that only he can make.
And so far, he's made the decision to continue with his appeals. So Jake's lawyers are working on crafting the next appeal, and Jake is trying to figure out a way forward. He says he's still doing all the things he did for years to stay positive and productive. He's working as a peer mentor. He's reading. He's nurturing his relationship with his family and his wife, Marta, who he married while he was in prison and who has been a source of constant support. But he's angry.
I, you know, remember you expressing anger when they brought you back and that being wielded as a weapon against you in front of the parole board. Are you worried about saying that you're angry?
If it's inappropriate for me to be upset and angry in this circumstance, then I don't know what circumstance it would be appropriate for me to be angry in. Or on the other hand, that I'm a sociopath who doesn't feel anything, you know?
Right.
Jake's dad, the writer John Edgar Wideman, has no qualms about being angry either. During my conversation with him last winter, he was trying to make sense of how the situation had come to this after everything Jake had done to win his freedom.
Of course, Jake had no idea that the possibility of 5 years incarceration, 6 years, endless, really, a lifetime of incarceration was at stake in terms of how he responded to this allegation that he had missed an appointment.
I can't know what the parents of Eric Kane, the boy Jake killed in 1986, are feeling right now. They haven't wanted to speak to me for this project and also asked me, through their attorney, not to contact other people in their lives who might be able to speak to their perspectives. I know they spent years advocating to the parole board to keep Jake behind bars forever, and then once he was out, encouraging corrections officials to arrest him and bring him back in. So I imagine this ruling comes as a relief to them, but a bittersweet one, because it won't bring Eric back. Nothing will. What are you feeling? After going on this journey with us, through Jake's childhood, Eric's terrible murder, through 7 appearances before the parole board, 2 special actions, 3 decades in prison, do you think something went wrong in Jake's case? Or did everything go exactly right? Was justice served? We'd like to hear from you. If you have questions you'd like to ask me or Jake or his attorneys or a victim's rights advocate or a legal expert, please call and leave your question in a voicemail at 347-391-3431. That's 347-391-3431. We're working on one final episode as we watch this case unfold. We'll hear from Jake, from his wife Marta. We'll be talking to state corrections officials working for Arizona's new Democratic governor. The governor came in promising reforms, but so far, the state's posture towards Jake's case, at least in court, has not changed. One thing that has changed is that the new administration is willing to talk to us, and we'll bring you their perspectives. We'll answer as many of your questions as we can, and of course, we'll continue to dig into the big questions that have animated us all along. Is there anything Jake can do to deserve to be free again? Is there anything he could say to convince the board, the courts, the people who loved Eric Kane, that he has served his time and is ready for another chance? Let us know what you think, and we'll see you soon for one last episode of Violation.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
I'm Al Edson, host of Reveal. From central Mexico to the front lines of Ukraine.
We were given an order not to take any prisoners.
From an abortion clinic in Florida.
A woman was just assaulted. Okay.
To the streets of Chicago.
More than 2,000 kilograms of heroin came to Chicago.
Reveal is your weekly dose of investigative reporting.
Somebody has to say something.
Subscribe to Reveal wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.